Like most people, pets are healthy most of the time, but when they suddenly show serious symptoms, and we're not sure why, it can be very stressful and obviously dangerous as well. Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, takes some time every month to spend with us and give us some advice on keeping our pets happy and healthy. And Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
Nice to be here again.
And there's a lot of things we can talk to. Tea tree oil is one. It's a common ingredient in cosmetics and skin washes.
You got it. I had a dog in yesterday, and the owner had, it was a young dog that had a skin infection on its ventral abdomen. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up is because she was asking, you know, isn't there something natural that I can use? And then it came up about tea tree oil. And this is something that a lot of humans use for treating acne and eczema and mm-hmm. all different insect bites and all different kinds of things. And there was just a report published not too long ago of 443 cases of tea tree oil toxicity in dogs and cats.
Wow.
And it's because not only, I mean, we typically, if we apply it topically, we'll just apply it to, you know, certain areas of our body. But if you looked at this puppy, it probably had a quarter of its body infected with this skin infection, which, you know, if they started applying this all over the dog's body and then allowing the dog to lick it, there's a very good possibility that dog would have become neurologic and even died. I mean, it's very serious. And so it just comes to show that, you know, just because it may be safe for us to take certain drugs or use certain, you know, cosmetic ingredients or, you know, therapeutic ingredients you can buy over the counter, may not be safe for our pets. And so always check first with your veterinarian before applying anything topically.
What are the symptoms of a pet having a toxic reaction to tea tree oil?
Well, they initially start getting very weak. They may start becoming ataxic, which is being wobbly, not knowing where their feet are in space. They may develop some tremors. They may start seizuring, go into a coma, and die. So, cats and dogs are both equally sensitive to it. So, you know, keep that product if you're using it for yourself to yourself. And even things like that we may apply topically, some of the therapeutic creams like estrogen cream or testosterone creams or different things that are we use, we have been seeing animal toxicity just because we're holding on to them and they're coming in contact with the drug that's on our skin. So just be real careful, you know, with anything you apply either intentionally topically to your pet or unintentionally by just having contact with them.
And if you suspect your pet has ingested some of that, get it to the vet?
Yeah. And the problem is that making them, like most people think, oh, if they've ingested it, let's make them vomit. But because this is a toxin that can affect their nervous system, if you make them vomit, there's a very good chance that they may inhale some of that vomitus because they are neurologically impaired. So by all means, contact your veterinarian, contact an animal poison control center, either through your veterinarian and get them in and get some help through either your veterinarian or emergency clinic or whatever. Bathing them is probably going to be, and supportive care, the big thing to get these guys treated.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. Thank you for joining in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You have some news that I know a lot of people are going to be happy to hear. And it turns out that dog dust may be protective against allergies.
You got it. You know, allergies are one of those things that can sometimes be a real problem for people that want to have a pet in their house. But one of the things that was really interesting is that when they, know this is research that's been done with mice so far, and so I don't know if it's going to work with people, but there's a very good possibility that it will. They expose mice to household dust, and it was either dust from homes that did not have dogs or household dust from dogs, homes that had dogs that are indoor, outdoor. And what they found is that the inflammatory reactions in the lungs, things like asthma and allergies and so on, were much reduced in the mice that were exposed to the dust that had dog dander and whatever the dog drug in from outside. And it just goes to show you that, you know, sometimes having a pet and not cleaning your house like as often as you should may be the best medicine to be able to keep yourself healthy. So now I have an excuse to not vacuum.
That is great. Chris in Wisconsin Dells has a comment here, I believe. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Hi. First thing I want to say is that sometimes I have to just thank the infinite wisdom of the University of Wisconsin system for keeping somebody like you employed.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, I want to do a shout out first. I just lost my last dog, and I haven't been without a dog for 34 years. I'm looking for a deaf Dalmatian puppy. So if anybody has one out there, they can contact the No-Kill Shelter in Oxford, Wisconsin. Can I give the phone number over the air? Is that okay with you?
The No-Kill Shelter?
It's a No-Kill Shelter in Oxford.
Yeah. I mean, I think you should be commended for taking on a challenging pet like that. Dalmatians, being white, have a higher incidence of deafness, and it goes along. It's genetic, and so many people that breed Dalmatians will have their breeding stock hearing tested. We do a brainstem audio evoked response, a bear test, and it has to be done by a specialist. So it's not something that everybody does. And you know, you can have a dog that appears to be able to hear, but if they're unilaterally deaf, and you put that with another dog that may be able to only hear in one ear, you may have some deaf puppies. And obviously those are going to be more challenging to train and work with. Not impossible, but just a little more challenging. And Chris, I bet you have had some experience with dealing with a deaf Dalmatian.
Yes, I have. As a matter of fact, I got a four-week-old deaf puppy. My veterinarian could have lost her license for doing this. But the woman that owned the bitch, her father, my dog's father, was the Midwest National Grand Champion. And as you know, the American Kennel Club requires breeders to put them to sleep. Mm-hmm. And so I got this four-week-old puppy squirreled away to me, and everybody just shut up about it. She was the joy of my existence. And she had a great life. She got leukemia when she was 7 years old and had a bad time at the end of her life. But we were intuitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, she followed me around the house. I trained her by hand signals. And there's a certain kind of a household that can handle this kind of a dog, and people need to know you probably shouldn't bring them into a home with children, mm-hmm. and you probably shouldn't bring them into a home with other animals that they haven't grown up with, because they can be a little bit squirrely and a little bit insane. Mm-hmm. But there is a certain kind of a house, and I'm one of those kinds of houses. I don't have any kids, and I've got some cats, but I'm looking for a puppy, so a puppy will grow up with cats. So if anybody has one, they can contact the Oxford No-Kill Shelter, and she'll refer it to me. And I'm on a 6-acre farm, so the dog can run. And that's not my question, but
okay.
We can just inform people about Dalmatians while we're talking about stuff. Did you know that the Dalmatian breed was made so crazy by Walt Disney?
That's one of the reasons why anybody that is going to be adopting another dog, whatever the breed is, you need to do your homework ahead of time so that you know what questions to be asking, to make sure that appropriate testing has been done of the dam and the sire. And, you know, just knowing what to be watching for when it comes to health problems that may be more prevalent in certain breeds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's get to the cat question. I have a cat that was born next to me on my bed. I've had him for 7 years. And he and I were like completely, completely in tune. He's a really, really smart cat. He knows his name. He answers commands. And
what happened to him?
Okay. I moved 3 times in 8 weeks. And for a very brief period of time, in that little period of time, the cats were kenneled in my vehicle while I was transiting because of situations. And when I let him out, he took off. And he was completely gone for 6 weeks, and I was sure a coyote or a hawk, because I was living out on a farm in the middle of nowhere. I was sure he was dead. Well, it got cold outside, and he couldn't find anything to eat, so he started hanging out again. And I trapped him, and he's now in my house, but he does not want to have anything to do with me.
Yeah.
He bit me the other day. I've been just trying to stay away from him and give him treats and trying to just talk to him. but he's not happy with me, and I was wondering if you had any advice.
Well, the first thing I would do is make sure that he doesn't have any medical problems going on. Being missing that length of time, he could have had some trauma, he may be painful, which may be why he's reacting the way he is and trying to avoid contact with you. It may be the new environment. It may also be the presence of the other cats. Once a cat is taken out of a home, whether it's involuntarily, like your cat, where he went missing, or even something like going to the vet clinic to, you know, have a physical done and procedure, and then you bring that cat home and just let him loose in the house, the existing cats are not going to recognize that cat. That cat can be have different smells on them. They may be in a little more anxious state, and so their body language is a little more stressed, and that can add to the conflict in the home as well. So I think what I would be recommending, one, get a good physical done. Number two, keep him isolated from the other cats. Let him get used to one room in your house. Don't try to be, you know, really in his face. Do everything, kind of just toss treats to him from a distance. Let him be the one to initiate contact with you. And hopefully that's, you know, that works for you. And, you know, we have had some strange cases where it's like a lookalike cat. There's a lot of cats out there that kind of look alike. And I'm wondering if you really have your cat or not. So that's why we always promote microchipping even in indoor cats so that they've got some form of permanent ID.
Thank you for calling, Chris. Appreciate your call. I want to give Dan in Partyville a chance to join in. So let's go to Dan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a 9-year-old male German Shepherd lab mix. He's got fatty tumors on him. I noticed in his mouth, on his upper right canine the other day, he's got what appears to be an abscess or a bubble on his gum line. That's, it's spongy. Can that be related to the fatty tumors, or should I see if it goes away or take him to the vet right away?
I think you should probably take him to your veterinarian. Fatty tumors are very common. They're called lipomas, and they can occur just about anywhere in the body. But I can tell you, in my 30-plus years of practice, I have never seen one in the mouth. And, you know, your dog is old enough that having an area that is enlarged in the mouth, it could be an infection. If we've got a tooth root abscess, you can get some gum swelling. There's a possibility that it's another type of oral tumor that may be starting as well. And that's why you need to get this checked out. And that's true for any new tumors or any new masses anywhere on the body, because just because your dog has these benign fatty growths around the body, it doesn't mean that the next one that pops up will be the same thing. Just for an example, I had a dog in a couple of months ago that ended up having a large mass wrapped right around, and it felt like a fatty tumor, but it was over the elbow, which is kind of a weird spot for a fatty tumor to occur. We did a needle aspirate, and it ended up being a type of cancer called a mast cell tumor, which was, at that point, except for amputating the leg, really not resectable. And so the family's working with oncology right now and so on, but that's why you always want to get any new ones checked out to make sure that it is something that maybe we can take care of sooner rather than later.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it, Dan. We have an email from Mary in Oliva who says her Siberian Husky, a year old, and seems to have a bruised dew claw. She plans on keeping a close eye on it, but wants to know if there's anything else she should be doing. Will it fall off, or should she be concerned about trimming?
Well, I'm not sure what she means by a bruised dew claw. My guess is that the dew claw is that little extra toe that dogs have that usually don't have contact with the ground, and they can sometimes get caught on something, and especially in this kind of weather where we're dealing with a lot of ice, dogs can get their nails caught and broken. And so, making sure that the dog is comfortable, isn't limping, isn't licking at it, and if the nail is, like, the shell is just kind of hanging there, although it sounds like it may be, you know, a bad thing to do, sometimes removing the shell of the nail and letting a new nail grow in is going, even though it hurts initially and it may require some sedation or even a light plane of anesthesia to get it done, then, you know, you've got a dog that's going to be much more comfortable afterwards rather than having a damaged nail that's bumping into things. So you may want to consider getting it looked at.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking forward to tomorrow's program, as well as our program today with Sandy, because Scott Craven will be joining us once again. Scott has been had some health issues, had some surgery, and so we haven't had him on the show since October, I think October 2nd, Judith tells me. And he's back, though, and hale and hearty and healthy, and we'll have a chance to talk with him tomorrow about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Today we're talking about the wonderful world of pet care with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. David in Racine has done that, and let's go to him. Hi, David.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Yes, my question is, should we be concerned about artificial fragrances that either plug in the wall or go into some type of bowl or vial affecting pets?
Well, if they don't have direct contact with it, I would not think that it's going to be a problem for them. But because many of those things that you're using may contain essential oils, they may be irritating. And especially the things that are like with the little heater, those little, you know, like wax melts or oil that you, you know, have a light or a candle underneath can become hot and may potentially burn the animal. But again, it comes down to knowing your pet. If you've got a pet that wants to put his mouth on everything, I would not be having a plug-in air freshener at, you know, mouth level for that dog. You really do have to dog-proof your house. But when it comes to, you know, unique toxicities or anything, I really can't think of any, but it would be something for me to do a little homework on to find out. But I think, you know, just you have to use caution whenever you're using any household cleaners that your pet may come in contact with.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Mona in Appleton. Hello, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 6-year-old Burman, which has long hair, and I also have a 15-year-old Himalayan, and they're both in real good health, and I feed them real good food. I give the male Burman, I give him just like a tablespoon maybe of canned food a day as a treat. And he, every once in a while, he gets the diarrhea, and he's had blood in his stool off and on through most of his life. When I got him as a kitten, he had giardia and some other kind of parasite, and I've had him checked and checked time again for that to make sure that didn't just somehow come back. And one of the times when he got real sick and he was throwing up and had diarrhea, he was sick, and then he bounced back, and then he got lethargic for a couple of days, and all of a sudden he threw up a whole bunch of mouth parts, live mouth.
Oh, my goodness.
I get mice now, and that I've been trapping them.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if he's eating mice and getting sick on them. I just trapped a few, and now I'm not getting any anymore. I can't figure out how they're getting in.
Yeah.
In older homes. So could they be getting – he could – excuse me, could he be getting sick on mice?
Very much, very. I mean, because they can act as a foreign body, especially if he's swallowing, you know, large chunks of them. And that just goes to show you that a strictly indoor cat can even be exposed to things that may provide them with parasites. The things that I get concerned about with mice is that they are often the intermediate host for a parasite called a tapeworm. Although most cats with tapeworms don't show very many symptoms, except for maybe having these little rice-like segments appear either around their anus or on the surface of their stool, or you may even see them on their bedding and so on. The other one would be roundworms and potentially hookworms as well. But those are the parasites that can sometimes cause, you know, vomiting and diarrhea. And so I think it's a great idea that you are having your cat checked out for parasites. You may want to even consider, even though your cat is indoor, if he's that avid a hunter, doing some therapeutic deworming, maybe even on a quarterly basis for something that's fairly broad spectrum that's going to get tapeworms as well as roundworms and hookworms. There's a couple of products that are out there. There's either a tableted form of a product called Drontal that you can use. And then there's a spot-on product, and I'm drawing a blank on the name. It's made by the Bear. Oh, Profender. Sorry, it took me a minute. There, I'm showing my age. But called Profender, and it covers the same parasites, but it's put on in a little tube up between the shoulder blades. And so most people like to use that one over the tablet. There's a huge price difference, so you're looking at probably 4 times the cost for the spot on, but you don't have the trouble of having to pill your cat. There are lots of other reasons besides hair and ingesting parasite, you know, ingesting foreign material or intestinal parasites that can cause the same symptoms that your cat has. And it may mean that you need to have some other, you know, what I refer to as the GI extravaganza done, where they may end up having some extra blood work done to look at gastrointestinal function. You may need to have some scoping done where biopsies can be taken. You may even want to just talk to your veterinarian about a therapeutic trial of something like a hypoallergenic diet to see if your cat has some type of a dietary hypersensitivity that may be triggering inflammatory bowel disease that can present with the same type of symptoms that your kitty has as well. That's going to be a problem, though, because you want mice to not be part of their diet when they're on that, a trial like that. So it may mean keeping them in a fairly mouse-proofed room rather than letting them have the whole run of the house where the mice may be more prevalent, such as in the basement and so on.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. We had, by the way, you were talking about some different medications, which reminded me about there was some new information to share about oral flea and tick treatments.
Yeah. We have had on the market several products that help with controlling fleas, not only but killing the adults when it's given orally. There's one that's called Comfortis that does that. But there's also some what are called insect growth regulators as well that are given orally. We have had nothing available orally that's going to kill ticks. And the Mariel company has come out with a new product called NexGard. It's a chewable kind of beef-flavored cube. Very palatable. I've already tested it on a couple of my patients that have come in. The downside of it is if you're living in a really heavy tick area, it does require the tick to bite to die. And so if you've got lots and lots of tick exposure, that may not be the product for you. But if you're living in an area, maybe in town, your dog is in an apartment, you walk them on a leash, they have very limited contact with areas where ticks like to hang out, like, you know, taller grasses and shrubbery and things, then that might be a very nice product for you to use where you're not dealing with applying anything chemically, topically to the pet. So I think it's got a nice niche for that particular drug. Is it going to be, you know, popular with everybody in Wisconsin? Probably not, but just know that it is out there.
Would an oral medication like that, would that be preferable to the topical treatment?
It really depends on the lifestyle of your pet. I mean, if you've got heavy tick exposure, you really need something that's going to potentially kill them before they start feeding. And, you know, obviously this drug doesn't do that because the parasite has to bite.
We have more callers online. Let's go to Marcia in Grafton next. Marcia, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for the program.
Sure.
I have a yellow lab who's 10 years old, and he was recently diagnosed with laryngeal paralysis. The vet's 99% sure that's what he has, although she hasn't done a scope on him. And she gave me a website to look at to see what the options are, and he's 10 years old, and I wouldn't consider the surgery for him at this point, and I'm just wondering what the progression of the disease is.
Yeah. You know, it's a very common condition in Labrador retrievers and other large breed dogs. And what this condition is when you are looking down at the throat in the larynx, there are these two folds called the vocal folds that open and close and protect, not only provide the dog with a voice, but also protects the airway so that food and liquids and so on can't get down there to cause troubles. But every once in a while, these either one or both sides, these vocal folds will just, you know, become paralyzed and kind of hang there in the airway. So what does this mean for the dog? It means two things. They may be more prone to aspirating things if they're drinking water in a hurry. You may see more coughing and things, and so they choke a little more easily. But the big thing is a problem with the thermal regulation, getting their body temperature down, because unlike us, where we sweat through our whole body, dogs only sweat through their nose and their feet. And the way they get rid of extra body heat is through panting. And so if your dog is on a hot, humid summer day and they're trying to move a lot of air past those vocal folds that are hanging there, you've got airway obstruction. And those vocal folds can become more edematous or swollen and actually aggravate the problem. And so we see these dogs, in fact, my old Basset Hound, who passed away many years ago, developed this in the middle of winter, and he did fine until our first warm spring-summer day. And then he was starting to have some respiratory distress. And I just brought him to work with me. I walked him from my parking lot, which is right across the street from the veterinary school. Before I even got into the front door, he collapsed from not being able to get enough air. And so he went right to surgery to have those vocal cords tied back so that he could breathe and not overheat. Now, the big issue with that is now you've got a wide open airway and more chance for them inhaling things. So you have to be a little careful. And some of these dogs do end up getting what's called aspiration pneumonia, but it can be a life-saving procedure. So my best advice is keep your dog in air conditioning when the weather's hot, limit exercise to what your dog can tolerate. And if you do see your dog, you know, really having a hard time breathing, getting them inside, getting them cooled down is, you know, will hopefully help, but it may require some emergency intervention.
Mm. Okay, thanks. I was really pleased with, I had recently changed vets, and it was a hard time getting this diagnosed. And he was having a lot of joint pain, and she put him on some fish oil and two herbs, Ligaplex and Boswellia, and he's doing so much better with his motion. I mean, he's looking like a puppy again.
Wonderful. But you have to be his brains for his breathing, because these dogs that are feeling good will overdo it. And and even though your veterinarian is 99% sure that this is what it is, I had a patient in not too long ago that ended up having a tumor in its larynx, and it presented just like a dog with laryngeal paralysis, that kind of really noisy, harsh panting, voice change, but it ended up being a tumor and progressed very rapidly. And so, you know, you may want to, it's a very easy procedure to just a light plane of anesthesia. We usually use a little bit of a drug called propofol, and then we get a laryngoscope and we just look down in there and we watch those vocal cords move. And it's so it's an easy thing to diagnose. And it may make you feel a little more comfortable that you're dealing with something that can be just managed medically rather than mm-hmm. something that may be not good news like cancer.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I thank you. He is mm-hmm. on two over-the-counter medications as well for an antihistamine and a decongestant, and those seem to reduce some of the coughing and mm-hmm. hacking and spitting up. But
Good. Well, I hope he has a long, healthy life ahead of him. You know, you're dealing with a senior citizen, and I hope he can stay comfortable for a long time.
Yeah. Thank you for calling, Marcia. Appreciate your calling. Good luck. We have more callers online. There are some open lines, though, at 1-800-642-1234. You can join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly. We were talking about tea tree oil earlier, and a caller phoned in to say that even for human use, if you buy tea tree oil straight, not just an ingredient in a product, it must be diluted. It's very highly concentrated.
Oh, yeah, and very irritating. And that's one of the problems is, you know, people using it inappropriately with their pet and not knowing that they have to dilute it. Thank you for that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Laura emailed us and says that she's 9 weeks pregnant and her dog has been acting so strange for about 5 weeks now. She will sometimes refuse to come near me, she says. She won't jump on me, but sometimes she will crawl up to me, snuggle, and is very gentle. Does she know I'm pregnant? How does she know if she does? Why is she acting so strange?
Isn't that weird? I mean, we know that there's dogs that can sniff out cancer, and you know they can be you know very helpful for certain types of like bladder cancers and so on, where they smell the urine and can detect who's got a problem. So what is it? What is it about you? Probably pheromones would be my guess. Something that you are releasing hormonally that is not, you know, evident to you, but maybe picked up on by your dog. It may be the fact that if you've got a little morning sickness or you're just not quite keeping the same schedule and, you know, behaving the same, your dog's picking up on those subtle changes in your behavior being newly pregnant that is changing the way your dog's interacting with you. So just enjoy the cuddle time that you have, and maybe you can hire your dog out and save people from getting pregnancy test kits. Not that I'm just joking, but yeah. So very unique call or email, and I wish I had an answer for you.
Laurel in Chippewa Falls has a question. Hi, Laurel.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 4-year-old cat that is pure white, long hair, has 2 different color eyes, and she's completely deaf. I've had her since she was about 5 weeks old, and she's always had litter box issues. She goes to, when she was younger, she'd go to the bathroom outside of the litter box, and it's just been a continual thing. Now I have a plastic boot tray that I keep a puppy training pad on, and she goes on that. The other cat goes in the litter box just fine. She will go number 2 in the litter box, but she will not pee in the litter box.
Yeah, and I, you know, and cats, this is not an uncommon problem. Well, one, thank you for bringing up the fact that a white cat with blue eyes, just like the Dalmatian we talked about earlier in the show, that's a white dog with the black spots. But white cats with blue eyes have a higher tendency of being deaf, even if they only have 1 blue eye or not blue eyes even at all, just being white. So that's great that you've given your cat a nice safe home. And I'm sorry that she's not making life easy for you. It may just come down to surface preference for the cat. You know, whenever I have a cat that has a litter box issue, we rule out medical problems. And I'm sure that your veterinarians looked at urine, made sure there's nothing wrong that's making your cat have an issue that is preventing them from wanting to use the litter box. But it may mean giving your cat a smorgasbord of different types of surfaces, and in the same area where you have that boot tray down, to just see if there's something that your cat may prefer to use. And, you know, I would be looking at trying things like maybe, you know, shredded paper, you know, some, you know, like, well, they make like shavings and things like that. Some cats will use those. I've had one owner actually use oatmeal. I know that sounds weird, but that seemed to be what the cat liked to use. So, you know, putting different substrates in to see what it is that your cat may like. And if not, this, I mean, you've got a solution. You're giving your cat this pad, and although it's not as convenient, you can't scoop it and you've got to change the pads, at least your cat isn't going elsewhere in the house. So, you know, count your blessings that way. You've at least found a solution. Yeah. But
And this solution has worked great for everything else that we have gone through with her.
Okay.
And it's just the best cat. She's just cuddly and sweet. And
Do you have more than one? Do you have more than one box?
Yes, we have 2 boxes.
Yeah, and you have, if you have 2 cats, though,
you
should have at least 3 litter boxes, and in different locations in the house. Many cats like to defecate in one place and urinate in another. Some cats couldn't care less, but for some cats, that's really important for them. And so increasing your litter box number, I've known people with 1 cat that have 7 or 8 litter boxes, just because the cat will not use it when it's soiled. There's certain locations in the house that if a piece of equipment is running, like a washing machine, they won't go in the basement. So you really have to, you know, plan your litter box strategy for the individual and not for yourself. And that adding another one in may be helpful as well. And if she likes to urinate in that spot, putting one right next to that area may be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Laura. Appreciate it. And let's go to Mary in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have 2 questions. One is this weather. I have a 15-pound, 12- or 13-year-old poodle mix. She's so perky, I think she must be 12. But when I got her, they said she was 3. And I'm wondering how I am not walking her in this weather. She's getting a little neurotic, but I try to run her in the house. What precautions do I take to let her out.
Oh, you know, and this is a problem for all of us, including me. This morning I got up and I have a dog door off of my kitchen to let my dog out in the backyard. And I kind of pushed her through the door and she turned around, came back in, ran over to her dog bed and emptied her bladder on the bed and peed. And so I now have her dog bed in the laundry right now. She refused to go outside just because it was so cold. And so sometimes being understanding that way, providing if they do want to, if they, you know, are trained to go on a certain surface, like the piddle pads and things that they make for puppies, that may be helpful. You know, every dog, their tolerance of the cold is going to depend on their age, their size, their hair coat, how low they are to the ground and with contact. And, you know, it's, you know, all of those things are things that the owner has to look at. Obviously, for a little poodle that like you have, they're not going to be able to tolerate the cold like a Siberian Husky who's designed to maybe spend more time out in the cold. Obviously, not indefinitely. They still need shelter and they need to be able to be out of the wind and up off the cold ground and, you know, extra nutrition and so on. But you have to be your dog's brains. And some dogs like to wear coats and boots. And I had an owner just send me a picture of her two Bichons all decked out in their winter wear. And they've got, if dogs could smile, those two dogs were smiling. And that's how they like to go out. And so she just keeps them dressed, you know, in the winter so that they'll go outside willingly. But, you know, and I think, you know, again, just you being the brains for your dog and being understanding like I had to be this morning. There were a few choice words that came out of my mouth, but I didn't take it out on Vanna. I just, you know, loaded up the washing machine.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Really appreciate it. And join us. If you have a question, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And if you got a nice pet photo, we always love those as well. And I'm going to take a look and see if we've got any of those. In the meantime, let's talk to Eric in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to follow up on the previous caller with her white cat that was having litter box issues. We actually had two cats that were best of friends for a long time, and then something happened where they became mortal enemies, and one cat stopped or refused to stay in the litter box, and we had a total of seven litter boxes spread throughout our basement at one point. And it took a lot of just sort of reconfiguring, putting it in different places, and then ultimately preventing the aggressor cat from actually being down in the basement while the other cat was using the litter box, because the aggressor would actually chase the other cat out of the litter box, which I think also was causing some of the litter box issues. We ultimately had to rehome the other cat with a family member. So they're both now in good places, and we no longer have litter box issues. But it's a difficult thing to do.
What is
going on with cats and you know where what their preferences are, like Dr. Sawchuk said.
During the break, the thing that popped into my mind is I'm wondering how much the deafness is involved with the cat not wanting to use the litter box. And I didn't ask the previous caller if the other litter box, rather than the boot tray with the absorbent pad in it, is like a covered box. But you can imagine if you are deaf and you've got a cat that may be kind of passively aggressive, may come over and bop you on the head as you're getting out of the box. That cat may avoid going in that litter box if she doesn't have the opportunity to be able to see the other cat approaching so that she can hurry up and get her business done. And so you always want to look at when you're placing litter boxes that a cat should be able to have what I like to call good escape potential. Having it in a dead-end closet, in a furnace room where they, you know, they have no way of being able to get out. Those are all spots where the cat may say, you know what, I can squat here because I can see down the hallway, I can see into the kitchen and the living room, and I know when that other cat's coming so I can hurry up and get out of the way. And so those are all things that when we're dealing with litter box problems, you have to address. They're not something that just is like a 5 minute here, do this and it'll fix. It's often looking at the social interactions with the cats, location of the litter box, what's in it, how often they're cleaned, the design of the litter box, the size of the litter box. All those things are really important, which is, you know, why working with your veterinarian or a behaviorist is helpful. Earlier you do it, the better. The average time I think owners wait before they contact their veterinarian is like 6 or 7 months of a cat not using the litter box.
Wow.
Before they seek medical help, which is just appalling. I think if you catch it early, we may be able to prevent some of these problems.
Hmm.
You're spot on that as far as the escape route, because that is actually what we found to work for the longest period of time, is to place the litter box in a place where well the one cat could see around and see the other cat coming.
That's
well, good for you for being so persistent, and good for you also for realizing that not all cats are meant to be living together. And I don't know what the trigger was to cause them to be, you know, at each other. But sometimes rehoming is, you know, the best for everybody involved, just so they both can have happy lives.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. And we have Darren in Chilton up next. Hi, Darren.
Yes. I have a 11-year-old black lab spaniel mix. We exercise a lot. She comes outdoors with me and skis with me and runs alongside. I'm finding that she is having a harder time getting up afterwards. She seems to be a lot slower. And I'm wondering if perhaps she has old joints and there's something I can give her over the counter to help her.
Yeah, and you know, it's not uncommon for a large breed dog that's 11 years old to have joint issues. I mean, gravity does its thing. There's genetics. There's just normal wear and tear. How often do you see, you know, a senior citizen being able to do exactly the same thing they did when they were a teenager? I mean, even, sure, you know, I look at myself, I go out and shovel snow and it takes me half a day to recover now. But, you know, the things that we like to look at when we're dealing with a dog with arthritis is, you know, again, ruling out medical issues such as things like tick-borne diseases that can cause chronic joint pain. So, you know, having some screening done for that if you haven't done that already, maybe getting x-rays done of if there's a certain joints that are involved, because there are sometimes things like partial anterior cruciate tears that the dog can still function, but because of the instability, they're going to be sore and it's going to progress to arthritis, and sometimes surgical intervention may be helpful. But if there's nothing that can be done that way, I like to, I use the little term, the WEDS program, WEDDS, and it helps me to remember all those things that we can do to help dogs with joint pain. Number one is weight control. Having a dog that's even carrying just a couple of extra pounds can really aggravate those joints. And so, you know, taking, you know, when you go into your veterinarian, say, really give me your honest opinion. What's my dog's body condition score? And do I need to be having my dog on a diet? The majority of people that have a pet that's overweight don't realize that their pet is overweight. It's like, welcome to Wisconsin. You know, it's like we've got, you know, our body image is, you know, is such that, you know, we are now looking at a heavier body image as normal. But, you know, and same with pets as well. E stands for exercise, and good for you for exercising your dog. But running along when you're skiing on a slippery surface or deeper snow may be more than your older dog can handle. So still exercise, okay, but maybe change the type of exercise to things like walking, you know, running maybe on smoother surfaces, playing indoors, going to an indoor dog pool if your dog likes to swim, because that they are available in the winter. And those are very helpful. The first D in the WEDDS stands for diet. And there are joint diets available, one by Hills called JD and one by Nestle Purina called JM. They tend to be very high in antioxidant vitamins, fatty acids. They do have some glucosamine in them. And some dogs do well with just a diet change that way. So again, something you'd have to get through your veterinarian, not available over the counter. D stands for drugs. And that would be pain medication, everything from drugs that work on the brain, like tramadol, to anti-inflammatories that work on the joints. And there's a whole host of ones that we can use. Be very careful about grabbing over-the-counter anti-inflammatories. I was in a pet store the other day, and they have dog aspirin there. And although they sell it at the pet store, and you would think, okay, if it's here, it must be safe, the aspirin in dogs tends to have more ulcerogenic properties, causing stomach ulcers. And so you have to be careful with using it. And many older dogs also have some underlying organ problems, such as liver or kidney issues, that can be aggravated by putting them on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So if you're looking at using something like that, get your veterinarian's advice. They're probably going to be recommending checking a little blood and urine before you go on long-term meds like that. The last letter, the S, stands for supplements, and these are things that you can usually buy over the counter. Glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, shark cartilage, fatty acid supplements, a whole host of things that are out there. Do they help? Maybe. We've got a study going on right now at the veterinary school testing out some new supplements. I know they're looking for volunteers to participate. And so if you're local, that might be something that you would want to consider doing with your dog as well. If you contact our orthopedic coordinator, they'd be able to help you with putting you in touch with the person that's doing this. So, lots of different things that you can do, but it mainly comes down to you being your dog's brains and sometimes changing the way we interact with our dog and our expectations with what they can tolerate.
And good luck. Thank you, Darren, for calling. I appreciate your call as well. We have many more callers online and a bunch of emails. Jan in Oak Creek says, my cat Carmine really likes to chew. He has a Kong toy now. She bought him a Kong toy. He likes it, but especially when there's a treat in it, but sometimes his canine teeth get stuck momentarily. Is this going to loosen the teeth, or will it just take plaque off?
Kong toys are rubber, and the ones that they actually make for cats are a softer rubber than the ones that they make for dogs. And so it's possible if your cat is really into chewing like that, they may get their teeth stuck in there, and all it takes is a little jarring motion, and you may fracture a canine tooth. So, looking into maybe some of the other things, like the little rawhide sticks that you may give to a dog, some cats like to chew on those. There are some other cat toys that are made with like a more durable fabric that you can actually put treats and things in, and as they chew and crunch them up, it may release some crumbs, and that can sometimes help. And I can't remember the name of it, but I had somebody actually bring one in and show me, and it's a very cool little thing that holds treats, but it's not it's a soft, flexible kind of fabric, almost looks like a fire hose type material. So it's quite durable, and that may work as well. But the big thing when you've got a cat that's a chewer is making sure things like plastic bags and electric cords and everything are all out of reach, since those sometimes are the favorite things for cats to chew on.
Dennis and Walworth, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Quick question for you. I have a 6, maybe 7-year-old Boston Terrier.
Okay.
And she, we throw a tennis ball with her, and she loves it. She loves to play fetch, and she really gets into it, either in the house or outside. But all of a sudden, she'll just stop and lick either one or both of her front legs. And then she won't play.
Yeah.
It's the strangest thing.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if she's licking because her joints are hurting. Is she limping at all when she stops? Do you see her? No?
No limping on her front legs at all. It's weird.
Very, very strange. Dogs will lick themselves when they're nervous. Sometimes it's like a nervous habit. They may lick an area, just like if we have our elbow hurts, we may rub it. Dogs can't use their other paw to rub their sore elbow, so they may lick at it. So sometimes, mild joint pain, even though she's not limping, it may just be that, hey, this is uncomfortable. And it may be, too, that it's just a learned thing, that she's learned that I stop, I lick, and guess what? They quit throwing the ball. And I can take a breather for a minute. So it may be that she's just trained you as well. But yeah, bringing this up with your veterinarian, having them do a good feel of the area where she's doing that licking to see if there's any joint swelling or discomfort. Maybe even getting an x-ray of that particular area of the limb to see if we've got any things like joint mice, which are little bits of bone that may be floating around in the joint cavity that may just get lodged someplace and cause some discomfort.
Hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thanks,
okay,
Dennis.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Kelsey and Rhinelander. Hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I have a 1.5-year-old pit terrier. He had broken his shoulder on a growth plate about September. He had to get some pins in. There was a lot of not movement. He ended up getting mites on his face from the stress of it all. But my question is, since then, he's been running around. He's been more mobile. But when we took his cast off, he had a bump that was hairless on the back of his leg that he had broken. The vet had told me that it was a tumor or something that most puppies get when they're young. But he's starting to get another bump on the same leg. This one is not hairless. Mm-hmm. And it's about a, I don't know, like a, it's pretty small. But the other one's about a marble size big.
Okay.
And I'm just kind of worried, you know, is it the same thing? Is something else happening? Could it be a blood clot?
Yeah.
Lots of things to think about.
Yeah. Well, the thing that comes to my mind is a young dog that gets a hairless raised bump on the leg. Sometimes they're ulcerated. Sometimes early on they're not. The most common type of benign tumor that these little puppies get, and they're usually under 4 years of age, is a type of a skin tumor called a histiocytoma. They're usually benign. They go away on their own. It may take several weeks to go away. Sometimes they're itchy and they're bothering the dog, and so we have to deal with it because of the dog traumatizing themselves. They typically like to be on the legs or on the face. But I also think that because your dog had his history of having Demodex, which is a very common skin parasite that pit bulls and bully breeds get, that you may want to have these areas looked at because it may be an inflammatory reaction to those mites. And so getting some cytology done, some skin scrapings of these areas, maybe a needle biopsy would be in order to make sure that you are not just ignoring something that may require other treatment.
Mm-hmm. Good points. Kelsey, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're talking today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her along. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page. Post a photo there at the Larry Mueller Show. Back after the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you are a pet owner, I'm sure you want to do whatever you can to keep your companion happy and healthy. But with so many sources out there, it's sometimes hard to know where to go for trustworthy information. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Net. Once a month, we have a chance to visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And I think she does a great job of staying on top of the new developments, sharing them with you and with me. And Dr. Sandy, it's always great. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's nice to be here. And you know what? I have some other good news. Back a couple of months ago, I reported that I had lost my bulldog Dozer, died acutely of a heart-based tumor. Very sad. And you know, but life goes on, and I'm adopting a retired 7-year-old bulldog named Gentleman Jim Dandy, but Mark wants to call him Bruce. So I don't know what we're going to call him, Jimbo, Dandy, Danders, you know, who knows, but right now, you know, it's all up in there. So we end up, we're another week and a half, and he'll be part of our household.
Ah, wonderful. Well, we have lots of people with animals, especially dogs that are part of their household online right now.
All right.
Let's take some calls. Gary and Madison up next. Gary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, thank you both. Our dog is a 64-pound mix, and he's been peeing every 2 or 3 hours throughout the day and night, and of course more so when we give him water and less so when we take it away at night, but it's still 2 to 3 times a night. We've had him in for blood work and a urine analysis. The blood work was, everything was negative. Urine analysis was inconclusive, so they put him on sulfoxylin for 2 weeks, and that didn't clear anything up. He's not dehydrated. He drinks a lot of water when it's there. I mean, he'll drink the whole bowl.
Oh, my goodness.
In the past, he's never drank hardly any water.
Yeah.
At night, he pants heavily at night. It shakes the bed. He has fat boomers on him. We've had
one of them removed and things, but there are others. But he's in good shape otherwise. I mean, very alert. Just everything is, seems fine. With
What your dog is displaying is something that veterinarians refer to as being PUPD, which stands for polyuric polydipsic. And it means drinking more and urinating more. And the big question is, which came first? And typically, when we see an increase in the water consumption, it's because the dog has to drink, because they are making more urine and their body's telling them, drink more water so that you don't get dehydrated. So this is something that you really don't want to water deprive your dog, but you do need to get to the bottom of it. And I know that you've gone through, lots of workup, but, and I would be doing exactly the same thing, saying, let's get some blood work. Let's get a urine sample. Let's see what's going on that way. And then kind of you have to, if you don't find anything, you have to start looking at doing some other specialty testing. The first thing that comes to my mind for a dog that's panting a lot, as well as, urinating more and drinking more, is a condition called Cushing's disease. And Cushing's disease is an overactive adrenal gland that produces too much cortisol, and that affects the kidneys and makes them want to drink more. And it also makes dogs pant. So they urinate more, they drink more, they pant. Very common. And there's a couple of tests that you can do. There's an easy urine sample test called a urine cortisol creatinine ratio that will rule out Cushing's disease. The problem is if you get it back and it comes back normal, you can say, well, my dog doesn't have Cushing's. If it comes back abnormal, it means you've got to do some further testing, which is usually some blood work that requires a brief stay, part of a day in the hospital. The other thing that I've had in recently is a dog doing exactly the same kind of thing that had fairly normal lab work. Even the calcium level was just kind of on the upper end of normal. But when we did a specialized test called an ionized calcium, we ended up finding that the dog did have elevated calcium levels, which is one of the things that can, again, cause them to have the same symptoms that your dog has. And this dog ended up having a small, non-palpable, we couldn't feel it by palpating the neck, but we did find it on ultrasound, a parathyroid tumor on its neck. And having that surgically removed made the dog back to being normal again. So you can see it may require your veterinarian kind of being the sleuth. I have this a page with about 30 reasons why dogs can drink more and urinate more. And we just kind of go down that list systematically, the common ones first, and then get looking into some of the more oddball things. But I think Cushing's disease rule out and getting an ionized calcium test done would be two very simple things that your veterinarian could do.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Gary. And Wes in Tomahawk. Let's see if I can get Wes on here. There. Wes, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. This is going to be very similar to the previous caller. I have a 6-year-old Springer, and he goes through streaks of what I call marathon pees, where he stands and urinates for, like, minutes at a time. And then he's fine after that. And New Year's Eve, he had to go about every minute. He had to go to the bathroom. And I took him to the vet, and she did an exam.
Mm-hmm.
And his prostate on one side was twice the size as the other side.
Wow.
And put him on amoxicillin, and let's see. That doesn't seem to be working. He was fine for a week, and then yesterday he did it again for like 2 hours. Had to go every minute.
Oh, my goodness.
And then after that, he's fine.
Is he neutered or intact?
He's intact.
He's intact. When we have a dog that is intact, the kind of two things that we think about, one would be like a prostatic infection, a prostatitis, or a prostatic abscess. And finding out what bug is there is going to be really important. Because of the way the prostate's made, you have to be careful what antibiotics you use, because it's very difficult sometimes to reach therapeutic levels of an antibiotic that any other organ in the body would respond to be able to get into the prostate. And so it may require doing things like a prostatic wash to be able to collect a sample, to be able to get an adequate culture to find the right antibiotic. Where I would probably be working with this dog would be getting just a sterile urine sample for a culture, because sometimes that gives us the answer as to what it is. I'd probably be looking at getting an ultrasound done on your dog to be able to evaluate what's going on with that prostate to see, is it just enlarged or do we actually have an abscess there that could be causing problems? And I would also be seriously talking to you about having your dog neutered. Once they're neutered, that will decrease the hormonal stimulation to that prostate and help prevent them from developing infections. And sometimes, you know, treating medically, we can get it under control, but it's just going to come back again. And so unless you're planning on, he's a stud dog, you're using him, there's a medical reason to have him neutered. Neutering is not going to eliminate or decrease the incidence of prostate cancer. And that would be the other thing that this potentially could be, is a prostatic tumor, which is not something fun for a dog to have, because they are almost impossible to surgically remove or do anything with, compared to what it's like in humans. And it's just because of the way they are built anatomically, it's difficult to remove. So you need to get to the bottom of this. And I think if your veterinarian isn't capable of doing things like sterile urine samples, prostatic washes, abdominal ultrasound, to be able to have a look at that prostate, it's time to get a referral to a place where there's an internist, somebody that can do all that for you, mm-hmm. so that your dog stays healthy.
Yep.
Well, I took a urine sample in with me and it came back negative. But she was kind of concerned. I can't remember how she phrased it, but there was basically nothing in the urine.
Okay. And it may be that urine was so dilute. I had a dog in recently that is a really good field trial dog, you know, lots of puppies on the ground. He's 11 years old, still being used as stud. And their complaint was drinking a lot and urinating a lot. He ended up having an E. coli infection in his prostate, even though his prostate looked normal, palpated normally. We were able to find that he had a little bit of blood on semen collection, and we treated him with the appropriate antibiotic for a good month, and that dog is now back to being normal again. And so the initial urine sample looked normal, but still culturing it, we ended up finding that he did have an infection there, and that E. coli was what was driving the dog to drink more and urinate more, because it produces a toxin that can do that in the dog's body. So, you know, don't give up on this. I think you still need to get to the bottom of finding out why he's got that one lobe of his prostate being bigger than the other.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you for calling. Benjamin in Milwaukee, hello to you.
Hi, my fiance and I have four cats. One of them is a Bengal who is about 3 or 4 years old. I'm not sure. My fiance has had him longer than she's had me. And so about a year and a half ago, we witnessed some weird behavior with him. His pupils would get extremely huge no matter what kind of light there was. He would get really, really energetic, and he would start, like, biting himself on the legs. And we noticed because, like, there were some hairless patches on his legs.
Mm-hmm.
We talked to a vet about it, and he said something along the lines of, that can be a mental disease with Bengals because of the wildcat blood in them, that the wildcat blood will kind of take over, and they'll, like, hallucinate thinking they're under attack, and they'll try to defend themselves, but they're really just attacking themselves. Have you heard anything
I deal with a lot of Bengals, and yes, they are a cross between a wildcat and a domestic cat, and they're beautiful, beautiful cats. But I would expect that most of the Bengals that are going to be out there now are not going to be first or second generation. You're going to be seeing them being, you know, very so far away from their wild roots. I would be more looking at a couple of other things. One, to find out, is your cat itchy for some reason? If they are actually stopping and biting and pulling hair out, It may be that the cat has some type of hypersensitivity or something that's bothering their skin, and having that looked into. There's a condition that we see, and if you know, just Google it, they call it fur mowing in cats, where like you're mowing your grass, where they just like chew the hair off and get down to, you know, having bald spots. And that might be something that your veterinarian can start looking into. And there's a whole host of things that can cause that. The other thing that I think is it may be plausible is the fact that this is also accompanied by a mentation change with dilated pupils. I don't know if he's twitching his skin on his back and just, you know, because some of these cats that have this condition, it's called feline hyperesthesia syndrome. It's a hypersensitivity syndrome. We don't really know what causes it. It's reported in dermatologic books as being potentially a primary skin disorder. You'll see it in veterinary neurology textbooks as potentially a seizure disorder. And we'll also see it sometimes listed in behavior books as a behavior disorder. And so nobody in their specialties has been able to come up with a reason for it. Many of these cats do respond to psychoactive drugs. Some of them respond to anticonvulsant drugs. So, you know, that would be one of the things that I would be thinking about. If you can ever videotape your cat when it's in one of these episodes, that would be something very helpful for your veterinarian to look at. And I also suggest that you go to like just YouTube. And if you just download feline hyperesthesia syndrome, you'll see lots and lots of cats on there that do this kind of wide-eyed look. Their skin's twitching. They take off across the room. They turn around. They bite themselves. They may traumatize themselves. And then they're back to normal again. So that would be my number one guess.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Benjamin. Carol in Crandon. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I have a 9.5-year-old beagle. Early last summer, he was diagnosed with pancreatitis, and he's had numerous blood work done. He has been put on an Royal Canin low-fat GI diet. He's had lost some weight. He's recently gained 2 pounds back because a vet said I could make some chicken broth and skim mm-hmm. off the fat, and he's recently gained 2 pounds. But all of his blood work shows that he has very low protein albumin levels that haven't been improved. He's on his fourth course of an antibiotic for his loose stools, and that usually helps him return to normal, but then, you know, 3 or 4 days later, you know, he's having loose stools again, and mm-hmm. he has had, you know, bacterial, you know, infections.
Mm-hmm.
He's recently been put on prednisone 20 milligrams, and the vet is very guarded about what's happening with him because he doesn't seem to be responding very well, and he's been on.
Do you know why your vet put him on prednisone?
She said to help with, you know, inflammation, and
okay.
if he does have cancer, you know, that
okay.
this is just a holding action, and
okay.
that if he does have cancer, you know, he would
yeah.
lose more weight and have more problems.
Yeah. yeah. Well, a couple things that I'd be concerned about. The pancreas is a very sensitive organ, and it involved with doing a couple of different things. One is it makes all the enzymes that are responsible for digesting a lot of the things that we take in orally, fats and so on, proteins and different things like that. And so sometimes when we've had an animal with pancreatitis, they stop making the same amount of those enzymes that they need because they've destroyed so much of their pancreas. And so that might be something. I don't know if your veterinarian has done a gastrointestinal panel. That would be something that we would look at. So you can see, are they, is your dog producing you know, enough of these enzymes and so on? Do we have something like a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? Do we have cobalamin deficiency? There's a whole host of things that can be problematic after a significant bout with pancreatitis. So that might be something you'd want to look into, because it may just be a matter of supplementing your dog with the appropriate enzymes, but you do have to get that as a diagnosis. I'm really concerned about the fact that your dog has such low albumin levels. You know, there's other conditions that can affect the body, but the fact that your dog's had this huge problem with pancreatitis, I start wondering if we have something else going on, like a protein-losing enteropathy, meaning that proteins are being leaking out of the intestinal tract and causing some problems that way. Has your veterinarian at all talked about doing any other diagnostic testing, such as scoping and biopsying, to be able to get an appropriate answer?
She has suggested to me, and just recently, an endoscopic,
right?
You know, yeah. Biopsy. Also, he has had, you know, small blood work, and he's had complete, you know, blood work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But even the blood work that we do at the veterinary school does not include gastrointestinal testing. We need to send that to an outside lab.
Yeah,
and it's
they did that.
Okay.
And they also, since he was diagnosed, that he's been on B12 injections.
Okay, good. I think that sometimes if this was my case and I had done everything like your veterinarian has done, and I'm just throwing up my hands and going, this dog is dying and I can't do anything about it, I'd be walking down, well, probably sooner than later, but be walking down the hall and talking to my colleagues in internal medicine. This is a point where getting a second opinion, I think, is really helpful. And you'd bring in all your lab work, you know, your dog, everything, and but they would sit down with you and try to figure out, because, you know, having more than one set of eyes on lab work and a patient is often very helpful. And I can't tell you how often it's like I just kind of hit myself in the head and go, well, why didn't I think of that? And, you know, we as veterinarians, we're not perfect and we don't know everything. And we really do sometimes need the help of specialists. And so whether your veterinarian has an internist in your area that they like to use, whether you want to come down here to Madison, that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about. Just throwing your dog on prednisone without really having an answer. One, prednisone can aggravate pancreatitis. And so I'm a little worried with that pancreatitis is in the history that we may be making things worse rather than better. So time for a second opinion. I think you've got a really complicated case here.
Good luck, Carol. Appreciate your call. And Susan in Eau Claire, I want to give you a chance. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Yes, I have a question about diabetes in cats.
Mm-hmm.
I've had two kitties that have had diabetes in the past,
mm-hmm.
and the second one I had to have put down in July. Mm. Now my 13-year-old female cat that I've had ever since I adopted her at 6 months is showing signs that are making me nervous. She's drinking a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
And with the treatment of a diabetic cat, I'm very puzzled why they can't have
the
oral med.
Yeah. It's because the majority of cats that are diabetic are what are called type 1 diabetics. They require insulin versus going on the oral drugs that people can take that have type 2 diabetes. And before you jump to the conclusion that your cat is a diabetic, though, you really should get them in just because she's drinking more and urinating urinating more, that may not be the only cause. Being a 13-year-old cat, we'll sometimes see things like kidney disease that can cause them to drink more and urinate more. Hyperthyroidism is also very common. And so getting your kitty in for a good physical exam, urinalysis, and some blood work is going to help alleviate your fears to what may be going on and get your cat on the right path of treatment. So I would hang up and call your veterinarian as soon as you get off the phone.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Sandy, we had Jeanette email us to say that the lab always slept alongside her husband. Once she became pregnant, the lab started sleeping right alongside of her, to the point that as her belly swelled, she would have to push the dog further away.
No.
So she thinks
there's something with some dogs that are able to detect pregnancy or whatever, and maybe just they are protective or whatever. But that's very nice, and I hope the baby and the dog are getting along well.
Apparently they are. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. She'll be back in a month, and we'll do this again February 11th, as a matter of fact. Tomorrow, Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist, joins us. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.